Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Good morning, welcome everybody. So, going to start the day long, and the theme of the day long suggested a couple sessions back, but we've gotten to it now. Is that around the word Kunti? And Kunti in Buddhism is a faculty, a power, a perfection of character. So, rather than a technique. Or one of the lists, like there is this noble truth, there is that noble truth. Kanti is more a characteristic, something we develop in ourselves. And it's not that it is the goal of spiritual practice per se, rather, it is a catalyst of spiritual practice. So the Buddha, not everything he points to is like you have to do this to get enlightened. It's more like, hey, this is one of the qualities, the characteristic, the things that help you along the way. And those are still good. Many of the blessings that the Buddha enumerates is just, it deals with having a good, balanced, peaceful, productive lifestyle. Why? Because that makes it easier to not suffer. That makes it easier to let go of attachments when things are a bit more calm. It's easier to be calm internally. So for just those reasons, we have a word and a concept like Kunti, but it's not like the most popular. And I think I can say that pretty easily, except I'm glad you all came. And probably some of that is just because it's either way, you get a day of practice. It doesn't matter if the theme is a complete flop, right? But if I were to say we're gonna talk about how to endure difficulties, probably it would be 50-50 whether that was really a draw or something. And so looking at the word Kunti and the concept, I think right from the beginning, we need to address that it gets kind of mismarketed. And some of that is just because of why we come to practice in the first place. So for a modern audience, it includes all of you people with your headphones and your your electronics and your day schedules and your families and your transportation and all of this stuff, you come to practice for a particular reason. Why is that? You show up, and every time you've like got your fingers crossed. You're like, maybe this time Thamma Pumuto will talk about jhanas. Maybe this time he'll tell me how to get samadhi. Maybe this time I'll finally get bright, glowing, beautiful, blissful mind states. And you're smiling because you'd rather hear about that. And that's just why we come. Like our lives are not bad, but we do suspect they could be better. And this is a totally different motivation than back in the Buddha's time when if you sat down under a tree, there was a 50-50 chance you'd be bit by a poisonous snake and die. I had a much different, reason to practice. There was much more urgency and much less, okay, things will be okay for the next 5, 10, 15 years. How can I improve them? So the reason we come kind of will it'll affect how we view some of these important Buddhist concepts. So many people, when they are introduced to the idea of Kunti, which you just bring up the definition here. So we have it right here. And it's not a complicated word. It doesn't have a bunch of references. You see some of these words, and you can follow them all throughout the suttas and look up the root and all of that. We have none of that for Kanti. It is a one and done kind of word with no nuances and no different forms. And basically translates to patience, forbearance, forgiveness, tolerance. Yeah. Where is it that we encounter that concept? Well, when we show up and we come first for meditation teachings, and then we get kind of calm, and the teacher says, and by the way, the reason I can give you these meditation teachings is because I've practiced the Eightfold Path and kind of calmed my own life. Would you like to learn about the Eightfold Path? And we say, okay, that might help. And so we start practicing the Eightfold Path. We get introduced to Kanti through this framework, through this lens. Like, how can it assist us with our meditation practice? How can it assist us with keeping the basic precepts and, getting closer to these blissful, happy mind states that we kind of hoping show up at some point? Well, through that lens, it makes sense that we would approach patience, tolerance, forbearance as something relating to the minor inconveniences that come up in the mind during meditation. Yeah, so I think for most people, the idea of Kanti and patient endurance is enduring discomfort and enduring pain, enduring sickness, enduring just all the hindrances and during the stuff. It's very reflexive. Yeah, look at like, what do I go through, and this is the stuff I've got to endure. And the kind of hope is, if we endure it, then we get past all of those reactions and we get to the place where we're just okay with everything. This is very interesting, because if we go to the suttas and we open it up and we look at where the word Kanti and the concept comes into play, we don't find it used so much for in this way. The fact that you would have to endure pain and discomfort from time to time was just a given in the Buddha's time. It's they didn't have shoes. They walked around barefoot everywhere in the rain and in the hot sun, and there were no screen doors, so yeah, bugs were a thing. They said the poisonous snakes, just ever termite mounds. How many times do those show up in the suttas, right? When was the last time you had to deal with a termite mound? And so, like, discomfort was just, it was woven into the basic parts of their lives. So they didn't think so much. Of course you have to endure discomfort. Of course you have to endure painful feelings. And that's really only relevant to us when it causes us to react in an unskillful way. That's when we want to practice. We were like, oh, I should calm my reactions here. But more where you see patience and tolerance and this concept of Kanti coming up is somewhere you probably might, it might not be your first thought about where to look for it, and that's dealing with relationships. But where it comes up in the suttas, it comes up with people say things and we get upset. Now, does that sound familiar? Does that sound relevant? I think so, right? And it's funny that this thing, which is it's easier to overlook, because when we're in a meditation environment, we don't talk to each other, is actually a major part of how the Buddha envisions using our practice and using this concept of tolerance. So there is one instance in the Jatakas, in the stories of the Buddha's past lives, where the Kanti becomes perfected, and it comes with a king shows up, and the Buddha is this renunciant. And the king accuses him of doing something foul with his concubines, with his harem. So he had found them there, and the Buddha was giving them a Dhamma talk, and he's like, "Oh, you've been doing naughty things with my harem here." And he's like, "No, I haven't." But the king falsely accuses him, and then he starts chopping off his limbs one by one, and the Buddha patiently endures it. Yeah, and so we have both concepts there, and it's interesting that before it came to the chopping and the severing savagely, of body parts, there was the vocal component. There was the accusation, the implication, the injustice, and the Buddha endured it. Because what choice did he have as a king? And you don't usually win when a king has a whole army to enforce his will, whether he's right or wrong. And this is really a reflection of like, oh, well, the Buddha talks about suffering, he talks about dukkha, he talks about the inherent inadequacies of samsara. Yeah. So how often do we feel that we're doing the right thing? We feel that we're doing the good thing. We feel that we're a right and good person. And yet bad stuff's So this is this perfection. Yeah. How do we deal with the all of the places where we could get really upset, we could get really indignant. Yeah. And it's not simply a matter of just dealing with it. Yeah. It's like, I'm just gonna sit here, I'm not gonna react, I'm gonna be calm, because if it, that's kind of again, that's if we approach it from a meditation standpoint, then it makes sense. Yeah, that's all we can. I'm going to keep trying. I have no idea why I just suddenly decided to do this, but we'll keep going. You all still there? Yeah, great. Losing track. If we're in a meditation environment, and we're all sitting around and nobody's speaking, then you just endure, right? And then the speech that you're enduring is probably assuming that the guy next to you is breathing too hard, or you're playing back some conversation you had and you're thinking, like, how dare they? And we all do this, right? But the Buddha and the enlightened disciples spoke very highly of Kanti, spoke very highly of this aspect of tolerance, because they had a different value for it. Yeah, for them, tolerance was not something that took energy, but something that produced energy. And there's an instance in the time of the Buddha before there was a big sangha of monastics, where there was kind of like nomad renunciants, and the Buddha would give a teaching and some people would get enlightened, and then they would just keep scattering because they were already renunciants, they were already wandering mendicants. And there was this incident where, without even planning it, this big group of over 1,000 fully enlightened beings came together on this one occasion at this one spot. And it was considered so auspicious that nobody had planned it. And they're just like, oh, well, those other enlightened guys are heading in that direction. I think I feel like heading in that direction. They all just showed up at the spot where the Buddha happened to be. And at this time, the Buddha gave a very brief Dhamma talk, which is recorded, and it's called the Avada Parimokkha. And it was the first instance of the Buddha giving any kind of monastic rules. So Parimokkha is the monastic code. And this was the first time where the Buddha gave any suggestions for how the monks might live their life in a way that they could transmit from monk to monk. And it's extraordinarily simple. Basically, don't sleep in public and be modest in how much you eat and, just cultivate the higher mind and don't get angry at people. Yeah. Don't be coarse. Don't be violent. Simple instructions. But what's more interesting is that the Buddha gives these to people who are already arahants. So, basically life is not perfect once you attain enlightenment. All of the th stuff that's you have to endure now, you would still have to endure if you became fully enlightened. Yeah. So it's like, what are we doing this? Yeah, that's not fair. But what does change is one perspective, and it's actually the very first line of the Avada-Padimokkha, which you, if you were very keen in reading ahead, you would have seen was right there in the definition of Kanti. And it's this line right here, Kanti paramang tapo titika. And this represents how we should begin to approach Kanti, how we should begin to see it. This translates to Kanti is the foremost producer of energy, basically. There are many nuances to this. In the Buddhist time, tapas was this idea of spiritual heat. Yeah, it gave us the ability to do things and to will the mind to particular directions. And there were all sorts of ways to kind of bring this up. And we do this too. And it's something that we probably overlook, but like the other day, I wasn't feeling so good, so I didn't come into breakfast. And for most people, missing a meal, especially when you have fewer meals in the day, might be like, oh wow, so I'm gonna have to get it back somehow. But when you're practicing, sometimes you're like, oh, this is a great opportunity to practice contentment. I'm not gonna eat, and I'm just going to be okay with that. And this is using Kanti, yeah? And there's an interesting way, the same thing takes place. You're going to miss the meal either way. But because of your mind state, you say, oh, this is going to be different from the norm. This is not going to be the most comfortable way of doing things. But this is a great opportunity to employ all the different things I've been practicing, contentment and tolerance and happiness with little modesty and just having a peaceful abiding. Yeah? So this is the Kanti that the Buddha is pointing to. And it's sort of I often think to like martial artists, because for us who live in sort of comfortable, simple, stable environments, this is how hard it is for us to actually get into this particular mind state, as we got to think of like, well, what if I really wanted to get strong and be able to punch through blocks of cement and be able to jump 10 feet in the air? Well, I would have to train. And how do you train? Well, you train with uncomfortable situations, right? You do 1,000 push-ups and you carry buckets of water and you have a meal that's only one bite of rice. And you punch a tree 1,000 times, 10,000 times, 100,000 times to kind of toughen up your muscles. And this is how martial artists, when they're looking to increase their tapas, their spiritual strength, they look for anything that is uncomfortable and they move in that direction. And even as they train themselves against these uncomfortable environments and situations, their energy doesn't go down, it goes up. They say, wow, I just punched the tree 1,000 times. Wow, I just did 1,000 sit-ups. It's like, wow, I've pared everything down. I've given everything away so that I've got the simplest possible existence so I can get up in the morning and until the time I go to bed late at night, I'm just practicing. This is awesome. And somebody outside is like, that's crazy. But for them, this is bringing up their energy. Yeah. And so this is this shift that we can kind of explore today, and we can explore ongoing with our practice is what is our relationship to discomforts. What is our relationship to when things are unfair, when things are unjust, when things seem wrong, when we would want to complain, when we would want to shift away from that circumstance? How do we bring the mind to, well, this is a great time to practice. This is what the Buddha was talking about. This is something I can let go of. And when we start to make that change, I think it's not that it's not about our meditation practice. I think it actually makes our meditation practice a lot more straightforward. Whereas before, our meditation practice might be sitting down and trying to get calm, and something comes up, and we're like, okay, I'm letting you go, I'm letting you go, I'm letting you go. We get back to calm. Our meditation practice starts to shift into, wow, where's the suffering? There it is. How do I deal with you? It's like we start to turn towards the tiny little discomforts because they remind us of what it is we're practicing for. And as we work through them, and like, oh yeah, my foot hurts, but I can be okay. It's like I was in that argument not too long ago, and that's playing back in my head. What if I practice, some loving kindness towards that person? I can just let it go. Yeah. And it's not that it's miraculously comfortable, but our mind state can shift to, wait, that's uncomfortable. That's great. I can use that to bring up my energy, to remind me, like, things in life will be uncomfortable. Things in life will be unfair. Yes, this is why we practice. Yeah. And that recognition of, like, this is why we practice helps actually bring the energy into our practice. It's a crucial component of it. Because if we were to just sit down and everything were to just be perfectly okay, and everybody in our life is a friend and says only supportive things, and we have tons of money, don't need it. The food we get every day, it's delicious, it's perfect. Love our job, love our family, everything's good. Then what are we doing? Which is, then we'll just sit there. And no enlightened person would tell you otherwise. They're like, well, if that were the case, then you're good. Just don't rock the boat. Yeah, it's fine. That's not a reality, is it? Almost everywhere we go, something will be unfair, something will be strange, something will be out of place. And it's a question of, like, how do we relate to it? So I did do a bit of time looking at that, but it's always great to bring up a sutta. I've got a couple brought up. One of them I would is actually not the sutta, but is one instance of where we see the Buddha doing this. And I don't know if everybody knows the story of Sachaka. And Sachaka was a pundit in the time of the Buddha, and he was known to be a debater. So he would go to other teachers of various disciplines, and he would debate the various points. And this was as close to the NFL as you could get in the time of the Buddha. This was a big event that people would come and see, these different philosophers debating, and until one of them could make the other break down and cry. And Sachaka was pretty good at that. That was kind of his thing. It was, I guess, maybe WWE is better. Like, he was a wrestler, and he would mentally break the other guy down until it was clear that his philosophy was garbage. But when he came up against the Buddha, we've got I think two or three suttas that play out how this goes. And the first Sachaka is incredibly coarse, incredibly disrespectful towards the Buddha, saying that he's going to wipe the floor with him, and it doesn't get anywhere. And in fact, the Buddha is able to just calmly walk him through a bunch of situations. They're quite wise. But also, Sachaka gets in trouble because he's approaching it with anger and trying to make the Buddha look stupid. He's brought into the situation where he wants to lie in order to get his point across. But you can't do that around a fully enlightened Buddha. And so there's also some mystical things coming in where he's realizing if he continues to lie in the Buddha's presence, or he doesn't speak when the Buddha asks him a question, it's going to be extremely bad karma. Now, this is the third sutta where, lo and behold, after a couple of these conversations, Sachika raises the white flag and actually becomes a lay follower of the Buddha and goes on to offer the entire Sangha a meal. Like he's won over. And one of the things he's won over by is mentioned at the end of the sutta here. And this is why is it we practice kunti and tolerance? Well, not only does it help us energetically, but because it is a wholesome state of mind to kind of be like, oh, this is something I can endure, this is something I can be patient with, that has positive consequences. Yeah. It might not immediately fix the situation we're in, but it does have positive effects on the world. And so, at the end of these discourses, Sachika exclaims, "It is wonderful, Master Gotama," and that's the Buddha, "it is marvelous that when Master Gotama is spoken to offensively again and again and assailed by discourteous courses of speech, the color of his skin brightens and the color of his face clears, as is to be expected of one who is accomplished and fully enlightened. I recall Master Gotama engaging Parinakasapa, one of the philosophers, in debate, and he prevaricated, led the talk aside. He showed anger, hate, and bitterness. But when Master Gotama is spoken to offensively again and again, assaulted by discourteous courses of speech, the color of his skin brightens and the color of his face clears." Yeah. It's very straightforward. And he says, "Look, I came here with an agenda, and I've been abusing you. I've been saying mean things. I've been disrespecting you, and you've been smiling back at me. You've been calm. You've been courteous. You've been polite, and you've pointed out the absurd things I would. You didn't cut me any slack. You definitely pointed out where I was, saying things that didn't make any logical sense. Yeah, and you're it, he Sachika is reflecting on." You just, the more I did to you, the more energy you seem to have, the brighter you seem to have. And I think this is what we find in our own practice, is the more we turn towards tolerance as a basic mind state, with this mind state of, oh, great, this is something I can be with, this is something I can practice with, the more it plants our confidence in the teaching, the more it really shores up, why we do this practice in the first place. And that just floods the mind with stability, with confidence, with brightness, with energy. Yeah. Another quick sutta we might, let me see if I can, Vipachiti. So Rachel actually pointed this out the other day. Yeah. Nice little instance where we find out why Sakka, the king of the gods of the 33. This is kind of the almost like Greek-like pantheon at the height of the the sort of basic deities in the Buddhist pantheon. Not the highest, upper level Brahmas, but in terms of our sphere of influence and those who have any kind of business with Earth. These are, this sort of like Zeus and Poseidon and all of these. Yeah, it's a very similar kind of pantheon. And Sakka is up there. But in Greece, Zeus is a kind of, he's doing a lot of naughty things. Yeah. But in the Buddhist pantheon, you don't get to be the king of the devas by drinking and womanizing and causing all sorts of problems in the world. You get to be there through virtue, and through, you have to have mind states that bring your energy up, because the life of a deva is a very high energy state. Yeah, it's something that requires a bright mind state. And it said that if the devas actually do give in to a mind of anger, they immediately fall from that state. Yeah, because their mind becomes coarse, therefore their body, their existence has to fall in line with that. In this instance, the Sakka gets in a fight with Vepicitti, who's the lord of the Asuras, and Asuras used to be in charge of this realm, and Sakka and the other ones kick them out while they're drunk, and they always keep trying to get back. And there's this sort of, like in the Greek pantheon, they're like the Titans. And so even I think Bhante Sujato translated Asura as Titan. And at one point they get in a battle, and Sakka manages to capture Vepicitti, the leader of the Asuras, and to kind of binds him up and puts him there in the middle of the square. And when Sakka comes into the square, Vepicitti just starts insulting him, abusing him, trash talking him. And Mitali, who is a sort of attendant to Sakka, says, why is it you put up with harsh words in the presence of this Vepicitti? Is it from fear or from weakness? And we get to see how Sakka gets to be Sakka, how you get to be king of the Devas in the Buddhist pantheon. And he says, well, it's not out of fear or weakness that I'm patient with Vepicitti. How can a sensible person like me get in a fight with a fool? And Mitali says further, he's like, well, fools would vent even more if there's nobody to put a stop to them. He's kind of playing the devil's advocate here. A wise person should stop them with forceful punishment. And Sakka says, I think that is the only way, I think that this is the only way to put a stop to a fool. When you know that the other is upset, you'll be mindful and very calm. How good are we at doing that? Is this something that we can train? Is this something we can practice and do? And Mitali says, I see this fault in just being patient. When a fool thinks he puts up with me out of fear, the idiot will go after you even harder, like a cow chasing somebody who runs away. And so Mitali is still is like, no, you've got to punish him. You can't put up with this. He'll just keep going. And Sakka says, let him think this if he wishes or not, that I put up with him out of fear. Of goals that culminate in one's own good, none better than patience is found. When a strong person puts up with a weakling, they call that the ultimate patience, for a weakling must always be patient. So Sakka is saying that, when a weakling puts up with somebody who's strong, nobody gets excited about it because they don't have much choice. Yeah, the weak person has to put up with the strong no matter what they do. But when a strong person puts up with somebody who's weak, that's when you really say, wow, that takes a lot of patience. That in some way, that is the ultimate kind of strength. He continues, the strength of folly is really just weakness, they say. Where says the, yeah, but no one can challenge a person who's strong, guarded by the teaching. Yeah, so when people say that a fool is strong, is powerful, he's saying that really they're just showing their weakness. When somebody is actually strong, guarded by the teaching, that's when the praise that you might give them is really well placed. When you get angry at an angry person, you just make things worse for yourself. When you don't get angry at an angry person, you win a battle hard to win. When you know that the other is angry, you act for the good of both yourself and the other if you're mindful and stay calm. People unfamiliar with the teaching consider one who heals both oneself and the other to be a fool. So Sakka, as he's pointing out, it's like most people won't get this teaching. Most people will misunderstand this quality of Kunti, but those who truly understand have keyed in on what it is that makes a person truly strong. And the Buddha contextualizes this as he's telling the story to the monks. He says, even Sakka, the lord of gods, while living off of the fruit of his good and bad deeds and ruling as sovereign lord over those gods of the 33, will speak in praise of patience and sweetness. But since you have gone forth in such a well-explained teaching and training, it would be truly beautiful for you humans to be patient and gentle. So these are some thoughts to get us started. So I'm not saying during walking meditation to go out and get in an argument and see if you can keep your mind stable. Yeah, probably because we haven't been thinking about it, but if you just watch your mind for a little while, you'll see that resentment, annoyance, frustration, grievance is there. Is lingering. Every now and then there's this little voice that says, how dare they? I'll show them. I'll get enlightened and then I'll come back and I'll be all beautiful and golden and radiant and then I'll show them. They never should have picked a fight with me. Right? And just listen to that voice and say, well, what if I flipped the script? And what if I said that, yes, they are wrong. Yes, this is unfair. Yes, that was mean. Yeah. But this is a great opportunity for me to be with it and to tolerate it and to turn the other cheek and to let it wash over me and not cause me any difficulty. Yeah. What if the biggest fault is not what they said, but is with me for getting angry at what they said? And so maybe this is the fault that since I have control over it, I should work on purifying right now. Yeah. And nothing, yeah, just be mindful, do what you're going to do. And if you're mindful of this fact, you'll see it, I guarantee. It won't be long. It'll come up. If you get through the whole morning and there's like this doesn't come up once, then I don't know, you'll get some sort of prize because I just don't think it's possible. I think you will have missed it, yeah. Because again, this is how when the Buddha talks about Kunti, this is how he talks about it, yeah, because this is where we really get to use it. Interpersonal relationships are just full of these. Right, so I'll leave that with you. We'll begin our sitting and walking, and we'll do that until 12 Eastern, and then we'll break for lunch.